Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is it so much easier to get hung up on the things that upset us than to relish the things that make us whole and healthy? As my guest today will explain, there are solid evolutionary reasons for our natural bias toward negativity. But since most of us do not face life or death struggles in our daily lives anymore, we can afford to tweak our deeply embedded tendencies so that our brains give greater attention to the experiences most likely to make us happy. Neuroscientist Rick Hansen is founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and an affiliate at the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. His new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. He joins us today from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Rick, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with this. What exactly is the brain's negativity bias?
Sure. It's the tendency of the brain to continually scan for bad news. Second, hyper-focus on it in a kind of tunnel vision when it finds it. Third, react to it very intensely with usually emotionally saturated reactions. And then fourth, critically important, to immediately store that whole mess, that whole experience and the stimulus set and so forth that came with it, to immediately store that in emotional memory or what's often called implicit memory. You know, in effect, once burned, twice shy.
And that makes perfect sense if we are trying to avoid dangerous animals and things that might make us sick. But it's not necessarily the best thing in a sort of modern life.
Right. It's really striking to just think about the number of ways in which this ancient tendency woven into our DNA fundamentally over 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system. It's interesting to think about the ways this negativity bias shows up in everyday life. For example, casually, if you think about a relationship you're in, let's say five positive things happen in a day, four neutral things, and one negative thing. Which is the one you're likely to think about just before falling asleep, right?
Of course.
Studies show that, that in long, strong relationships typically need at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative experiences or positive to negative interactions. That's a cautionary tale. When I came across that in grad school, it really made me think about my marriage in a new way. But anyway, also, it's so easy to train people in a sense of futility, learned helplessness, and it takes many dozens, typically, or certainly a large number of counter experiences to unlearn that sense of helplessness and reclaim a sense of confidence, a sense of agency, that you can be a hammer, as it were, instead of a nail going through life. So the negativity bias is quietly at work. It's a great way to keep animals alive in really harsh conditions. But as you said in your opening, these days when with many unfortunate and tragic, sometimes exceptions, most people have a reasonably decent life. You know, they're not running and screaming terror from a lion all day long. Therefore, this negativity bias creates a fundamental bottleneck in the brain that obstructs those experiences which, as you also said, would be most useful to us, the ones that are most capable of growing resilience inside or a positive mood or confidence or compassion for others or feeling loved oneself. Those experiences are very poorly translated into neural structure. It's a kind of bottleneck. It's almost like a learning bias or a learning disability in a fundamental kind of sense. And what we can do, though, is using the methods that are rooted in hundreds of studies on the neuropsychology of learning in very practical ways. We can take the extra 5, 10, 20, 30 seconds to help ourselves convert these passing mental states that would be useful to us into lasting positive neural traits woven into the fabric of our brain.
Okay, so explain this term, this takes us perfectly there, that you have in the book, experience-dependent neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm. This is the fundamental idea that's been supported really easily by a century of science, that our thoughts and our feelings, ourselves and certainly those of other animals, our thoughts and our feelings, what we pay attention to, how we react to it, and so forth, is continually sculpting the brain, changing its structure and function for better or worse. The modern breakthroughs in the last 10, 20 years, which have really kind of galvanized the field of psychotherapy as well as other areas like education, say, or character development or peak performance in business, addiction and recovery, and so forth, is to really appreciate the details of the ways in which if you stimulate certain key circuits, as it were, in your own brain, you strengthen them. Unfortunately, the brain is biased toward a strengthening process that goes negative. For example, chronic stress, even mild to moderate chronic stress, releases cortisol, a stress hormone that goes back up into your brain and then oversensitizes the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, and weakens the hippocampus, a different region of the brain, that both puts things in context and calms down that alarm bell. Well, you can see where this goes.
Yeah.
It means that stress today and, you know, cortisol releases sensitize the brain to negative experiences, which make us more stressed the day after, which makes us really vulnerable to stress the day after that. So that's a way in which experience-dependent neuroplasticity can occur negatively. On the upside, though, it can also occur positively, especially for those experiences that we give focused attention to and then stay with, you know, that extra dozen or two dozen seconds. So we sustain the enjoyment, let's say, of a moment of accomplishment or a moment of kindness from another person. They smiled at us, or a sense of just happiness or fulfillment or even a good lesson, you know, learning the lessons of life and helping them stick to the ribs. If we actually can trick our brain in its structure-building processes by sustaining focused attention to some experience past a certain threshold that's roughly around 5 to 10 seconds and more better, right? If we do that, we can actually engage in self-directed neuroplasticity, gradually stimulating those networks and circuits that are really positive, and by stimulating them, strengthening them. Since in the famous saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together wire together.
Okay, so Rick, we have all had those days where because we are stressed or things aren't going well, it almost seems impossible to notice the good things, right? We drive through a beautiful morning and all we can think about is the traffic. We sit down and we have coffee and we don't even taste it because we're thinking about the meeting we're going to. How do we get in the habit of noticing the positive things even amidst a day that might be really tough?
Sure. There are a lot of really important points embedded in that question there. For one, sometimes there's no place for a positive experience. You know, something dreadful has happened,
right,
you know.
Right.
You just have to ride out the storm. It would be inauthentic. I live in California, and I've seen way too much superficial positive thinking. What I think is important is to be able to see the whole world as it is, the whole mosaic, all the tiles, both the negative and the neutral and the positive, recognizing that we've got this Stone Age brain that does tend to over-focus on and especially overlearn from the negative. So sometimes you just have to ride out the storm. But that said, as soon as you start having some kind of free attention, even in the middle of a very busy day or even in the middle of dealing with difficult things, you know, you've got a loved one, let's say, in the hospital, there still could be the opportunity to have some positive experiences that would be authentic. They would be appropriate in that setting, you know, a sense of love for others or a sense of your own abilities to just get through a difficult time. And then, critically important, it's not just having the experience that's so important. That's what the neuropsychology of learning teaches us. It says just having experiences that are positive are usually wasted on the brain because they're not converted into neural structure, while negative experiences are immediately converted into neural structure, right? Never forget. So if we're having that positive experience, don't waste it, because most positive experiences are actually wasted on the brain. They have no lasting value. They're nice in the moment. They're better than the alternative, but they don't change anything. They don't steepen our learning curve in any way. The critical opportunity for people, certainly a half dozen times a day, not making it the entirety of a person's life, but a half dozen or so times a day, we have an opportunity to help the learning land. So we don't waste it, and it ends up having some kind of lasting value for us, especially in terms of emotional learning, character learning, becoming more mindful, becoming happier, becoming more confident.
So you talk about the difference between having an experience and sort of having it on your mind for 5 or 10 seconds and then trying to extend it so that it lasts 30 seconds or more. I mean, what does that look like? What's the difference in that short amount of time that makes it able to stick after 30 seconds?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. Any kind of improvement in life. You know, developing anything inside oneself is a matter of learning it, or another word for that really is memory, broadly defined, especially that fraction of memory that's really the great majority of memory, which is implicit. You know, our attitudes, our expectations, our assumptions, the internal emotional atmosphere of the mind. Okay, so the question then becomes, what's the how? Fundamentally, of healing or everyday effectiveness and well-being or personal growth altogether. What's the how of that? And the how of it is a two-stage process. Stage one, we need to be having a mental state of some kind. We see something, we remember something, we think about something, we feel something. Now we're having an experience. It's activated. But the critical stage is the second one. That's the installation stage, in which this momentary mental neural state becomes converted into some kind of lasting neural trait. And that installation process takes time. This is an organic system, you know. It takes time to build structure. It takes time to shift function. Now, neurons are typically firing 5 to 50 times a second, right? So things can happen fairly quickly. But it's still not instantaneous. This means that we need to maintain the pattern of neural activity that underlies whatever thought or feeling or desire or form of attention we're having in the moment, whatever underlies our actual subjective experience. There's an underlying pattern of neural activity. If we sustain that pattern of neural activity past some kind of threshold, which is on the order of 5 to 10 seconds, it starts efficiently converting into neural structure. But if we don't hold that experience in short-term memory buffers long enough, 5, 10, 20, 30 seconds at a time, depending on the situation and what the experience is. If we don't sustain the experience in those short-term memory buffers long enough, it doesn't install into neural structure. It gets dislodged by the next incoming experience, neutral, negative, or positive, and then the one after that and the one after that. But they don't have time to sift down into, to become converted into lasting neural structure. That's why it's been really humbling for me as a longtime psychologist to appreciate how many positive moments or useful thoughts or feelings, body sensations, what have you, that I've cultivated in myself or my children or certainly in my therapy clients that are just wasted because they don't make any lasting change. They don't get installed in the brain. I think psychology and other forms of education and development, we're really good at having or activating a positive or useful state of mind in the first place. But we've tended to be kind of lousy at the installation phase. And for me, that's where the real opportunity is, to actually take these useful experiences and then convert them into lasting resources inside that people have with them wherever they go.
Neuropsychologist Rick Hansen is my guest. His new book is Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Need to take a quick, a little overdue break right now to remind you that we are trying very hard to wrap up the fall fundraising campaign today. We would ask that you call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org to make your contribution. I'm joined now by Think executive producer Jeff Whittington. We want to remind you that this is a pretty amazing day for us. If we can end this day as soon as possible, every contribution that that's being made at this point is being matched dollar for dollar by the extraordinarily generous Donna Wilhelm, who has done so much to help us in the past. You know, she wants us to remind you, and we want to remind you, that these programs are not free. There are costs to produce them, the things you hear on KERA, to pay for the programs that come from elsewhere, to support reporters and hosts here. It's important that everybody does their part.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. Of course, Donna Wilhelm's a longtime supporter and board member of the station, and really want to thank her for making this challenge. Again, your contributions match dollar for dollar. And Chris, we're just looking for $36,500 and change from listeners. That means there's about $73,000 left to raise overall, but Donna's going to match your contribution dollar for dollar. So please make a contribution right now. Be generous. Make that extra gift. Call 888-694-6931.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen, who is founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. His new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So, Rick, we all have these needs for safety, for satisfaction, for connection with other people. How do those play into our overall sense of well-being? And how should we match experiences to those needs in order to wire our brains in a positive way?
That's a really deep question. So as the brain evolved, it did so in three stages, essentially the reptilian, mammalian, and primate-human phases of evolution that map loosely to the brainstem, the subcortical limbic system with things like the amygdala and the hippocampus in it, and then the modern prefrontal cortex and the other parts of the cortex, the outer shell of the brain that links very much to primate and human evolution. So as we evolved, so did our ancestors' capacities to meet three fundamental needs of any animal: needs for safety, to avoid harms, needs for satisfaction, to approach rewards, and needs for connection, to attach to others. Now, obviously, the ways in which a lizard connects or fulfills its attachment needs is very different from, you know, high school students getting ready for a prom. But as we developed in these ways, it's important to appreciate that needs in certain areas need resource experiences in other areas. I mean, your summary of my book, which was so articulate at the opening of the hour, in which you said, this is about greater attention to those experiences that will change the brain for the better. Certain experiences are going to be more useful for meeting our safety needs, while other kinds of experiences, for example, would be more useful for meeting our connection needs. This means that you can then look for those particular antidote experiences available to you in everyday life that could most address particular issues. For example, if someone has issues around anxiety or anger, and by issues I mean very normal range things. In other words, they're things that are worrying them, let's say, or things where they feel attacked in some way, unprotected, or ways in which they feel perhaps helpless. I think of those in terms of our safety system. Other people think this way as well. This framework I'm talking about here is fairly widely used in psychology. And if someone has needs or issues in those areas, if you think about it, certain key experiences of relaxing or noticing that in this moment you're actually all right now, or experiences of protection, or a sense of agency, being able to be a cue ball rather than an eight ball, you know, in life. Those are key experiences that will really serve a person's needs in the area of safety, to avoid harms, for example. And that's particularly important to have repeated experiences that address core safety needs, because those needs are most managed by ancient systems in the brain, rooted in the brainstem, you know, the inner iguana, as it were, the inner lizard that's inside every one of us, me included. And those parts of the brain are slow learners. They don't have much neuroplasticity there. They don't change very readily, especially compared to more modern parts of the brain in the cortex, for example. So that's the takeaway from that is to appreciate that we need to repeatedly register and internalize useful positive experiences that address our sense of anxiety or anger or helplessness, because those learnings, as it were, in terms of our safety needs are hardest to change. Anyway, and you can apply the same general principle of antidote experiences to issues in other areas as well. People, for example, who've had experiences that are frustrating or disappointing in terms of their satisfaction needs that are managed by a regulatory system in the brain that approaches rewards. Or maybe they've had a loss. Those matters are very well addressed with antidote experiences, for example, of gratitude or gladness. In other words, reward experiences or everyday pleasures. I think everyday physical pleasure that's wholesome, let's say, is really underrated from it in terms of a mental health factor. It's very good for our mental health to have basic experiences of physical pleasure in the body, et cetera. That is really rewarding for us. And then last, as many people do, me included, you know, where the action really tends to be for us is more in the relational system. We feel maybe hurt or left out, or we're looking for love, or we tend to look for love in all the wrong places perhaps, or we've been disappointed, or we're carrying inside us maybe some residues of a childhood in which there was a fair amount of rejection or exclusion, as it was for me personally. So therefore, for that kind of person, target experiences to really look for in everyday life, and then when you find them, to help them gradually sink into you would be really useful in terms of experiences that relate to our attaching system or connection needs, like being included in small ways in everyday life, or seen by other people, or appreciated, respected in some way perhaps, or certainly liked or even loved. Any port in the storm, you know, any opportunity to have those experiences is really good. And bit by bit, from the inside out, you can gradually take charge of the sculpture building processes in your own brain, the structure building processes in your own brain, and gradually alter things in a way that is increasingly shown in research.
So I've discovered that on my worst day, sometimes the most comforting thing I can do for myself is imagine a scenario that could be that much worse than what I've experienced. Is that just perverse, or is there some value to that?
No, it's actually a well-known way to see the good and the bad, or another way to think of it is to, through comparison, imagine things that could be worse. That's really good, especially for a certain kind of person. On the other hand, some people, when they do that, they start ruminating about the negative, right?
Oh, so like, and it will happen if you imagine it worse.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you're also getting at the distinction that's useful between what we do in situations versus what we do offstage to prepare ourselves for situations. Hmm. So earlier you were talking about people in tough conditions also being able to see some things at least that are positive. You know, for example, if you can be happy that children are happy, well, you can always be happy because somewhere, some child is happy, right?
Right.
If not an adult as well. So there's a place for doing that kind of thing in situations, including things like being aware, or by contrast, how much worse it could be. But what also really helps is offline, in everyday moments in life, look for ways to build up those resources inside so that when situations occur, the inclination of our mind is already trained, in a sense, toward a more realistically confident, hopeful, happy, you know, calm, resourced way of dealing with the situation so that, you know, when challenges occur, we can stay, as it were, in the responsive mode of the brain, you know, one of its two basic settings, rather than tipping into the reactive fight or flight red zone approach of the brain. We're still dealing with challenges, mm-hmm. but we're doing so on the basis of feeling already internalized a strong sense of inner peace and contentment and love, rather than, you know, feeling like we're running on empty or being carried away by some sense of fear or frustration or heartache.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Chris on the line in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. I was curious if you could talk specifically to, I guess, some of the work that you've done, if it relates directly to panic disorder or other depressive mood disorders. And I will take my answer off air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. There's considerable research that by repeatedly learning experiences of calm in general and relaxing the body especially, that is a good foundation for dealing with any kind of anxiety issue, whether it's, you know, sort of just everyday tendency toward over worry or anxious rumination, you know, kind of rehashing things over and over, as well as for more significant forms, consequential forms of anxiety, including panic disorder. Additionally, a really important experience to internalize is what's called distress tolerance. In other words, being able to feel worried about something or to feel sad or frustrated or angry, let's say, or inadequate to feel it without overreacting to that reaction, which is where a lot of the trouble begins. So there's this term in psychology called distress tolerance where we can actually allow ourselves to feel uncomfortable without panicking about feeling uncomfortable. So, for example, one of the treatments the caller may know for panic disorder is to breathe through a straw and deliberately activate a sense of worry or concern in the body that it's not getting enough air, but being able to ride out that discomfort without overreacting to it. And then, in particular, to internalize that sense of being able to ride out the discomfort, that sense of feeling okay. I'm not liking this, breathing through a straw. You know, it's not fun, but I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay. And through repeatedly taking the good, I call it, repeatedly registering that fundamental experience that you want to learn from, you gradually weave it into yourself, which illustrates a larger point that many of the experiences that we are taking in and many of the traits, the inner strengths we're growing, are not really about happiness directly. They're about factors of happiness or thinking of happiness in a very broad sense as well-being, fulfillment, and inner strength and inner peace altogether. And second, we internalize these resources often to deal with hard things. You know, this is not for me about some kind of like Pollyanna take on life, rose-colored glasses. It's about really appreciating that life is often difficult. And what we really need to do as a practical matter is to develop inner supplies, inner resources, inner strengths inside us that are increasingly are with us wherever we go.
Neuropsychologist Rick Hansen is my guest. He's founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. His new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. You know, the books around here, I love to share them with my coworkers and people. I've already had a couple people that the book has already promised to somebody to read next. I think a lot of you would like to read it. We do have thank you gift copies available today when you make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month. You can do that at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back with us in studio now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And it's a very exciting day here. We are working to successfully conclude this fall membership campaign today. And we have a lot of help, actually, from a KERA board member, a longtime supporter. Donna Wilhelm has very generously offered to match every dollar you give, every single dollar you give. So if it's time for you to renew your membership, maybe you've decided to become a friend of the station and give $1,500. Well, guess what? Donna Wilhelm's going to match your $1,500 contribution.
It's
dollar
amazing.
For dollar.
Yeah.
And that means that we have about $32,560 left to raise, and then the drive ends. I mean, that seriously, that the drive ends the minute we raise that last $32,568. We're no longer waiting to hear, though, from Emily Miller and Mark Rosen in Dallas, Mike McWilliams in Dallas, Carol Solo in Denton. Also heard from Marge Stockton and Keller. Thanks so much to Jerry Van Lowe in Dallas, Tom Chancellor in Fort Worth, and Susan and Michael Harrison in Plano.
Yes, we also want to say thank you to Stormy and Wendell Parker in Fort Worth, Nancy and Brad Purifoy in Colleyville, Felipe Ramirez in Fort Worth, Pam Kiefer in Arlington, Jan Renfro in Fort Worth, and David Anderson and Chanel Mosley in Denton. So thank you to all of you. Thank you to Donna Wilhelm. This is a perfect day to make your contribution go twice as far, thanks to Donna's generosity. And then we'll go back to full programming. We'll put the staff, people like Jeff and like Stephen Becker and like our new staff and like me, full time back to the job of bringing you the news, the information, the content that you rely on KERA for.
Yeah, please be the next one to call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. All the thank you gifts we've mentioned during the drive are still available, by the way. So when you make your $200 contribution, we'll thank you with all four seasons of Downton Abbey as soon as that fourth one is released in the U.S. on January 5th, plus the bonus DVD, The Secrets of Highclere Castle. It's a $200 contribution for you, but it's a $400 contribution to KERA because Donna Wilhelm will match your contribution dollar for dollar. If you'd like to give $10 a month to the station, we can thank you with your very own copy of Professor Hansen's book, Hardwiring Happiness. It's yours when you join the station with a $120 contribution.
I'm very interested in happiness topics, and I always like when they are rooted in science, right? Because everybody's got their philosophy, and that may be great. But I love talking about this with people who have really a great understanding of how the brain works and have looked at research and have tested all these things. The book is a fascinating read. We would love to send it to you. Again, $10 a month or more. Certainly don't limit yourself to $10 a month. 888-694-6931 or kera.org online. We would love to hear from a new friend or two, or maybe a renewing friend this afternoon.
Yeah, we're talking about hardwiring happiness. Well, you can get your virtual soldering iron and make the call, and everyone in the North Texas area will be very happy, that this membership campaign successfully concludes today. Please be the next one, 888-694-6931, or go to kera.org and make your contribution. You know, these programs are not free. It may seem like they're free. You just turn on your radio and there you are listening, but you know, they have a cost. I mean, everything has a cost. We got to turn the lights on. I mean, at the most basic, we have to heat and cool the building. But we also have to have some pretty sophisticated equipment so that you can wake up with Sam Baker, so that you can listen to the show and the station via the internet at your desk at work, or maybe while you're driving around in your car. All this stuff has a cost that we have to pay for. And most of the money that comes from KERA to pay these bills, well, first it comes from you when you make your phone call to 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. We want to wrap up this drive as soon as possible.
Your part in this might be $5 or $10 a month. Your part might be $125 a month at the Friends level. Certainly, Donna Wilhelm is more than doing her share with her incredibly generous match offer for today. But public radio works because everybody who believes it's important comes together and helps to cover the cost of making it possible. You know, another cost that Jeff didn't mention but that is real is that we hire professional journalists at this station. We don't have people come in who say, hey, I'll try my hand at reporting. We have people with years of experience, with training, with you know, the ethical values that are really important and create the best possible product. That's because you expect nothing less from us. We are thrilled to be able to be the organization that provides it to you, but it does come with a cost. So we would ask that you take action today to make this station work well, to get back to regular programming, and to maybe get a thank you gift for yourself at the same time. 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
888-694-6931 on the web at kera.org. Just got an update, Chris. $32,418 left to raise from listeners. And every dollar you give today, if we can end the drive today, will be matched 100% by KERA board member Donna Wilhelm.
That's an amazing offer. So please take action now, 888-694-6931 over the telephone or online with a transaction that takes just about 2 minutes at kera.org. We'll be back to our conversation in 2 minutes with Rick Hansen, author of Hardwiring Happiness.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen. His new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rick, talk a little bit about people whose sorrows today are rooted in past traumas. What steps can they take toward healing and then resetting the way their brain looks at even minor frustrations in the present time?
It's a very real issue, including just in terms of people whose traumas are quite recent. You know, even the Pentagon estimates that roughly about a third nearly of soldiers coming back from tours in the Mideast, et cetera, you know, have PTSD. So post-traumatic stress disorder. So, you know, trauma comes in all kinds of forms. And I frankly think that a lot of micro traumas can add up to a macro trauma. So one thing that people can do, and these are methods that are quite well used in psychology, what my book really zeroes in on is how to turbocharge this process based on the actual neuropsychology of learning, you know, 10, 20 seconds at a time. What people can do is hold an awareness at the same time, both a positive experience that is the natural antidote to whatever negative experience they've grappled with or events that occurred, and also be aware of something about that negative material, not getting sucked into it, but by predominantly staying with the positive experience, such as a sense of feeling strong and safe today, in contrast to feeling unprotected and attacked as a child, say, or feeling today that there's a lot in one's life, there's a lot that one's grateful for, one's been blessed in many ways, while alongside having a sense of maybe a loss that occurred either recently or in the past, or holding in awareness today a very strong sense of being loved and appreciated and valued, while also having a dim sense in the background, let's say, of feeling abandoned or shamed growing up or in a previous relationship. If you're aware of both of those things at once, positive and negative, making the positive more prominent, it will gradually associate with the negative, since, quote-unquote, neurons that fire together wire together, and gradually soothe and even eventually replace the negative, thinking of the mind-brain system as like a garden, you know, in effect, well-chosen flowers can gradually crowd out weeds. And if I could do a little riff here that's connected to your pledge drive on this point, as I was listening to the pledge drive, I was thinking to myself as a major fan of public radio that many studies show that actually people get more pleasure from giving a monetary amount, like $20 or even more, to some kind of charitable undertaking or nonprofit. They donate it, as it were. They get more pleasure from donating the money than keeping it for themselves. And simultaneously, even as they experience subjectively more pleasure, more fulfillment, systems in the brain that are involved with reward really activate, really light up, particularly systems that have to do with what's called social pleasure, which are founded on or rooted in more ancient systems in the brain that are engaged with physical pleasure. And it's also the case that even for those people who feel let out, left out, or helpless, or mistreated by others, or dealing with any kind of issue or pain, amazingly, by being giving oneself, whether it's in the form of a small donation or even a large one, let's say, to your radio station or to other people, and including in ways that are intangible, that giving of love, very broadly defined, that expression of generosity, broadly defined, actually can feel fulfilling rather than depleting, which I think is really quite remarkable. And then the opportunity, of course, is to take those extra dozen or two dozen seconds to register the whole experience of giving and the sense of reward from it, which can help you feel more fulfilled and stronger and more loved inside, actually, and also can incline you more in that direction in the future.
Well, thank you so much for that. That was amazing, and I heartily agree with you. Let's move on. Right. We have some more questions on the phone here. Let's see what Steve in Dallas has to say. Hi, Steve.
Hey there. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
And it's really timely for my family, and now I'm a little bit anxious. My daughter is the product of two individuals that have anxieties and insecurities and have had to work to overcome those. All the points that your doctor is talking about are just spot on. But the daughter had to move to New Jersey for a job, and then she's moved to Houston for a job, and she's all alone. So that's the background. I want to ask if you can contrast religious-based psychotherapy against more secular-based psychotherapy. And the point being that the mother and the daughter are more conservative and strong in their faith, and I'm more liberal. So I guess that's my question.
Interesting question. Thanks, Steve.
Well, first off, this is a daughter who has a sense inside her of a loving and good father. So that's an incredible resource, you know, to draw upon routinely. And as a parent of young adults myself, 26 and 23 with my wife, we've been married a long time, you know, I really appreciate what it's like to still feel deeply for our kids, you know, even though they're adults. So the question now about faith-based psychotherapy or counseling broadly defined compared to, let's say, secular types. I haven't seen research that contrasts them head-to-head. I do think, generally speaking, that a psychotherapy that feels culturally relevant to a person is going to be most valuable, whether that person that person's culture, you know, as they're grappling, let's say, with life on the streets and addiction, and it helps to have someone who can actually talk that talk from the inside out themselves, or someone who's relating to their own psychological issues in a more faith-based frame, you know, speaking within that frame, I think could actually be quite helpful to people. You know, at the end of the day, most fundamentally, outcome in a therapy is going to be based on the motivation of the client and the level of functioning of the therapist themselves, not so much the methods that are being used. So if you have some confidence, you know, in the motivation of the client, in this case, the daughter, as well as the overall capability of the therapist, you know, then I think you can probably be pretty confident about it. It's interesting that psychology, which has historically tried to have an arm's length relationship to religion to kind of preserve the, as it were, purely scientific aspects of the field of psychology and psychotherapy, lately has really been coming to appreciate over the last maybe dozen or two dozen years, the power of religious life for many, many people as a major source of inner resources and well-being altogether. So one doesn't have to be a faith-based therapist oneself to, on practical grounds, turn people's attention to the resources that are available in their faith or their religious community, if that's of interest to them. Obviously, if a therapist gets involved in proselytizing in some way, that's inappropriate. But if you don't cross that line, I think there are a lot of resources that are available in religious life for people.
What do we know about those remarkable individuals who seem to naturally find it easier to dwell on the good stuff, and what can we learn from them?
That's a great question. You know, if you want to get good at anything, study people who've gotten good at it, right? If you want to become a good father, think about, you know, what Steve is doing here. Or more broadly, think about the contemplatives. That's been a great interest of mine. People across the world, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, Islam, shamanic, you know, the native people's contemplative traditions, which I think deserve more respect. These are people who have really trained their minds. Now, whatever might be true about transcendental X factors, if you will, God, spirit, whatever, whatever is true about that, in addition to that, these are people who've really trained their minds to focus attention, to cultivate loving kindness, to find, you know, a resilient capacity in themselves, no matter what happens. And what's happening now in science is that since they've trained their minds, they've changed their brains as a result, and people are now studying their brains. And what's interesting are some of the takeaways that we can use ourselves. For example, people who've deeply trained in compassion in different traditions in the world, including in Buddhism, for example. These are the monks that are most commonly studied. People who are trained in compassion are inclined to take action. So again, a shameless plug, but a true one. People who are inclined to feel compassionate about those who are engaged in non-governmental organizations, you know, that part of the economy that's the nonprofit sector, including in media, which I think is incredibly important. You know, people who have compassion in that direction, who are mobilizing their heart, as it were, also start activating motor circuits in their brain that can incline them to take action toward the objects of their compassion, you know, including their favorite nonprofit, let's say. You know, more broadly, I think that the takeaway deeply is that people who've really practiced and cultivated inner strength, inner contentment, and inner love, let's say, is that they're able to deal with tough things in a very centered and grounded way because they've repeatedly internalized those experiences so that even when they're dealing in a conflict environment, there's a peacefulness inside themselves. They're strong, they're assertive, but they're not going to war with the other person. They're not tipping into the red zone, as it were. Or people like this, when they're dealing with loss, think about losing your whole country. Think about the Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama and all the rest of that, essentially being exiled by the Chinese government. When something like that happens, can you still be aware of the good things in life that are fulfilling you? Or if you have people who are dealing with being mistreated by others or abandoned or shamed or even attacked? Can you still have love in your heart for these people who've mistreated you? Can you turn the other cheek, as it were? And can you be strong and speak up for yourself while not losing sight, you know, of the being behind the eyes, as it were, in your political adversary or the person who's mistreating you? You know, the people who've done this kind of deep mental training that we're talking about here are able to do these things. So we can do the reverse engineering increasingly through modern science. That's a lot of what my book gets at. You know, how can we study what they're doing inside their heads or we're doing ourselves when we're in a really good place? And then how can we work backwards through the reverse engineering about thinking about, okay, what are the circuits that are active, that are lighting up, as it were, in the mind when people are rooted in a very strong sense of inner peace, no matter what's happening? And then how can we work backwards to stimulate those circuits inside ourselves? And then based on stimulating them, gradually strengthen them because, quote unquote, neurons that fire together wire together. And I find this time is historically unprecedented, the intersection of three circles, brain science, psychology, and contemplative wisdom. And at the center of those three circles is a real sweet spot for opportunities to, you know, as we face a lot of challenges in the 21st century, take more responsibility for our own Stone Age brain and start gradually and authentically rewiring it from the inside out.
Rick Hansen is founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and an affiliate at the Greater Good Science Center at Berkeley. His new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Rick, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Chris, it's been a delight and an honor to be here. And go the pledge drive.
Thank you. Hopefully it's the last day. If you would like to support the pledge drive, the fundraising drive, you can make your contribution now at kera.org or 888-694-6931. Not only can you receive a thank you gift copy of Hardwiring Happiness, really a fascinating piece of work, at the level of $10 or more a month, today, our amazing friend of the station and board member, Donna Wilhelm, is offering to match the contributions that you make today dollar for dollar, assuming that we are able to finish this all out today. We have about $29,404 left to raise from listeners. If you think about the extraordinary generosity of Donna Wilhelm, it becomes easier and easier to think, I can do $5 or $10 or $20 or $50 a month. And imagine that. I'm happy to know that Donna must be having incredibly good feelings. Hopefully, according to Rick Hansen, all of you are feeling really good about your contribution to KERA. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And this $29,404 that's left to raise from listener contributions represents less than 4% of the overall goal of the drive. We raised far more than that on the first day of the drive about a week and a half ago. So your call right now to 888-694-6931. Your online gift at kera.org will get us there. I want to thank Leo Molina in Fort Worth, Don Warnke in Dallas, Julia Smith in Denton, and C.J. Dowling in Lakeside. Thank you so much for making your contribution. Those folks' contributions are going to be matched dollar for dollar today, and that deal extends to you, too. So if you've wanted one of the thank you gifts, if you want a copy of Rick Hansen's book, Hardwiring Happiness, this is the time to make the contribution.
Thank you, Elizabeth Folly in Garland and Ruth Sabiel in Aledo. Thank you, Trey Bowles in Dallas, Patrick Melly in Dallas, Linda Norwood in Dallas, Maria Estevez in Irving, Sue Mottinger in Dallas, and Susan Quante in Dallas. Really appreciate everybody.
888-694-6931 on the web at kera.org. If you're already listening online, click over to the donate page. You can see the banner at the top of the page when you go to kera.org. It says donate, and it says on there how much is left to raise, so you can watch it in real time as we get contributions in on the phone, as we get contributions in on the web. It's really important we hear from you today. Again, if you've just joined us, really exciting news. We learned this morning that KERA board member Donna Wilhelm called in and is going to match everybody's contribution today, dollar for dollar, to help end the drive. And we started this morning with about 70,000 left to raise from listeners. And now, Chris, $29,404 left to raise from listeners to make this happen.
We really appreciate your generosity, and we know that's what it is, but we also know that you want us to get back to full programming, to get back to doing the work that you rely on us to do rather than fundraising for all these hours. The faster we finish raising all this money so that we can sort of continue and make sure that we can pay our bills in order to serve you, the faster we will do that. We would like to end this fundraising day as soon as possible. Folks like Blaine Rush in Dallas and Elaine Allen in Granbury and Tim Little in Grapevine have done their part. So why don't you follow them and take advantage of the amazing generosity of Donna Wilhelm, who is offering a dollar-for-dollar match today of your contribution in any amount. Take advantage of that. Make your contribution now, 888-694-6931.
Or do it online at kera.org. If you can see the friends level, $125 a month is something that works for you. Well, that $125 a month contribution, that $1,500 annual contribution will be matched dollar for dollar today only. So call now, 888-694-6931, or click and contribute at kera.org.
Takes a very short time to make your contribution, and yet whatever amount you give goes straight to work for you here at KERA. Anytime you turn on the radio, you can hear your money being spent and know, hey, I did that. I helped to make that program. I helped to bring you that episode of Morning Edition or All Things Considered or any of the other programs. 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. We'll